Collection Practices Act claim brought in district court. The matter went on to the regular procedure and came to jury trial. During the jury trial, at the close of my case, I was plaintiff's counsel in the underlying proceedings, the district court granted judgment as a matter of law on three separate issues, and it's on those three separate issues that we've now brought this appeal. Specifically, the court granted judgment as a matter of law on the claim that the debt collector had failed to state the amount of the debt as required by Section GA1, also that he had misrepresented the character, nature, or legal status of the debt in violation of Section E2A, and that further, that he had made false or misleading written representations in an effort to obtain money or property from my client in violation of an Indiana law. As a result of these entries of judgment as a matter of law, we now appeal. At the conclusion of my case here, we'll ask this court to reverse the district court, enter judgment as a matter of law in favor of Mr. Veach, and remand for trial exclusively on the issue of the applicability or not of the bona fide error defense provided by the FDCPA and Mr. Veach's damages, if appropriate. The standard of review here on the underlying proceedings is, of course, de novo. With reference to the standard of review, or standard of consideration, more likely, of the underlying events, it's the unsophisticated consumer standard. And this circuit differentiates itself from the other circuits, which use the least sophisticated consumer standard. But by whatever name it's called, the unsophisticated consumer standard is low. It's very close, as they say, to the bottom of the sophistication meter. So, although my client is a relatively bright gentleman, he is deemed to be an unsophisticated consumer for purposes of interpreting the act that we're here today discussing.
From your standpoint, what should the language of the debt notice have said?
Your Honor, on page 22 of our opening brief, we provide our effort at mimicking this court's effort in the case of, for example, Bartlett versus Heibel or Miller versus McCalla. On page 22, we provide what we think would be a safe harbor letter for any debt collector to use in attempting to hit what is arguably a moving target in a case such as this.
So you don't think there was any need to mention the $1,000 figure?
Your Honor,
I
no.
I mean, because that's what's missing in this suggested language you have on 22.
We think at this stage of the proceedings where the debt collector is simply complying with the notice requirements of the Act, it would be inappropriate and a violation of the statute to mention that in the context of being an amount of the debt. So on the one hand, we do have an oxymoron, that is the juxtaposition of incongruous matters resulting in a possibly perceived epigrammatic effect, but that is not the case. In this instance, we contend on the one hand, Mr. Sheeks, the defendant, failed to state the amount of the debt. The way he did this is pursuant to his own exhibit to the notice of claim. And I say it's an exhibit because it doesn't matter what it's attached to, actually. It could have been attached to a notice of claim and sent to the appellant. It could have been attached to the car contract. In this instance, coincidentally, it was attached to the lawsuit. But what he told my client was that his remaining principal balance was $1,050 plus reasonable fees as permitted by law and costs if allowed by the court. It's indisputable that on the date that this notice was mailed, the exclusive obligation that was out there by Mr. Veach was a dishonored check in the amount of $350. Therefore, the representation that the remaining principal balance was actually three times that amount is a misrepresentation. It's fair to state the amount of the debt because no sum certain is actually identified. By sum certain, I'm talking about a number that a debtor could say, ah, I have to write a check for this amount. This is the sum certain that I will write that check for and thereby discharge this obligation to this debt collector.
Counsel, do you admit on page 30 of your brief that the $1,050 amount was an alleged obligation due?
We agree that he alleged that that was an obligation due, but we don't agree that that was a legitimate alleged obligation.
No, but do you admit that it was an alleged obligation due? My next question is, and that reflects the treble damages. Is that right?
It does reflect the treble damages, Your Honor.
And then does this qualify as a debt under the FDCPA?
It does qualify as a debt in that the obligation was incurred for personal, family, or household purposes. That's not in dispute here. With reference to the $1,050 as an alleged obligation, he could have alleged the obligation of being $5,000, and that would have qualified.
It's not what he could. It's what do you admit that it was in your brief?
We agreed that Mr. Sheeks alleged that $1,050 was
due. What did you say in your brief? What's the exact language?
On page 30?
Right.
Let's see. At the second sentence of paragraph C, we state, rather, the $1,050 was an alleged obligation due.
Okay, that's what I asked you. Right?
Yes. That is an alleged obligation due based upon the notice of claim filed by Mr. Sheeks.
Okay.
With reference to the failing to state the amount of the debt, it's clear that nobody could discern what amount of debt, or excuse me, what amount of a check could be written to satisfy this obligation. On the other hand, and simultaneously with this, his notice of claim also misrepresents the character, nature, or legal status of the debt, because from the perspective of an unsophisticated consumer, the representation that his remaining principal balance is $1,050 could have the effect on that person of representing that it's been determined as a matter by a judge, because that's how this was conveyed to Mr. Veach, that is, by way of a lawsuit sent to him. It could mean to that unsophisticated consumer that somebody's made the determination that his alleged obligation is $1,050 plus these other cryptic sums for reasonable attorney's fees and costs. This flows directly into the representations that were false, that were made in writing, and were clearly made in an effort to obtain money or property. Before Mr. Sheeks filed his lawsuit against the appellant here, the creditor did send out a notice, and it's in the materials, where they do actually state a sum certain. They say you owe $350 on the check plus a $20 bounce check fee, total $370. They stated the amount of the debt. Mr. Sheeks took that and made a giant leap forward and made the representation that Mr. Veach now owes $1,050. The only intervening event was the mere passage of some time.
Counsel, let me ask you something else about your brief. Don't you claim on page 22 that Sheeks could have obtained the protection of Judge Posner's safe harbor letter in Miller?
With slight modifications of the language set forth, because
right,
of the issue.
Now, how could that happen when the Miller case was decided 6 months after Sheeks sent his notice of claim to Veach?
Oh, we don't contend he could have relied on something that did not then exist. Rather, the concept that here is a form of a representation to a debtor stating the amount of the debt that would pass muster under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and under the idea that
I'm referring to what you said in your brief.
Yes, we set forth the safe harbor language from Miller.
But the decision came out 6 months later.
Yes, we're not calling upon anticipatory knowledge by Mr. Sheeks at all. We're saying here's how this circuit has addressed this issue in the past with similar situations. We're not saying that he has to have the prescience to discern in anticipation what this court will do. Rather, simply complying with the statute by stating a sum certain for the debt that's allegedly due, as opposed to representing that it's a determined fact that he owes $1,050 plus some ambiguous statement about fees and costs. For these reasons, we think that the compendium of the facts set forth below demonstrate that a reasonable jury, properly instructed, could have found in favor of Mr. Veach that Mr. Sheeks violated the FDCPA by failing to state the amount of the debt, by misrepresenting the character, nature, or legal status of the debt, and by making false written statements in an effort to obtain money or property.
This is not a question related to the issues here. I'm just curious, given the amount here, $350, were there settlement efforts made?
There were settlement efforts made very close up to.
Before the trial?
Yes, Your Honor. I can't recall specifically how close up to, but we were within just a couple of $1,000. This issue is one of significant importance because of the volume of these types of collection cases in Marion County, Indiana.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Moss, and I'm representing the appellee Charles Sheeks in this matter. This case comes before the court from an FDCPA jury case tried in the Southern District of Indiana. At the close of plaintiff's case, the district court judge, on a motion under the Rule 50A1, directed verdict in favor of Mr. Sheeks.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes,
Judge
sir.
Williams asked a question about settlement that didn't really have much to do with this case, as she acknowledged, and I have one that doesn't really have much to do with this case, but I don't understand how this guy became indebted in the first place here.
How Mr. Veach?
Yeah. How he became indebted. Wasn't this a situation where he sent a $350 check to the creditor to help out his girlfriend's
Correct.
Son or something like that?
Correct.
So how does he become indebted?
Well, we did not raise the issue of whether that was a consumer transaction under the FDCPA. It was a insufficient fund check, which is a transaction under the FDCPA.
How was that insufficient fund then?
Pardon me?
He authorized the check. He issued the check.
He stopped
and
payment on the check.
No, wait, I know. But that was a valid check.
Correct.
How does it become an insufficient check when at the time he had sufficient funds in the bank to cover that check?
Because under the Indiana statute, he stopped payment on the check. He was then sent a notice of dishonor.
Well, does that make it an insufficient fund?
Under the statute, it does.
What language in it that says that, please?
Judge, it says a person, and this is 35-43-5-5, it says a person who knowingly or intentionally issues a check, which he did do, knowing that the check will not be paid or honored by the credit institution.
Now let's stop there.
Okay.
The time that he issued the check, are you contending that he knew that he had no intention of paying the $350?
Not at the time.
Isn't that the language that's there?
That is correct, Your Honor. But then he stopped payment on it. Our client.
So he stops payment, but at the time he issued the check, he intended to pay it.
I'd have to agree he intended to pay it at that time, yes. But then he sent a notice of dishonor later on after that check does not clear, and he ignores that notice.
I want to get back to my question. Why isn't this guy just some complete stranger, a volunteer to this stranger? If you owe MasterCard $1,000 and you're a little late, and I think I want to help you out, so I sent him $500 in a check and stopped payment on it a little later, how do I become indebted to MasterCard?
On that check that you wrote.
Yeah.
And the Indiana statute provides notice of dishonor to that person who wrote the check to try and clear that check and pay the check. He has an opportunity to do that. Once
he doesn't.
But where's
the consideration that you've given? And that's, I mean, why, I think I'm just a complete volunteer if I do that. Why isn't this guy just a volunteer? He wanted to help out
but
his girlfriend's kid who was having her car repaired.
But the creditor does not know that. They are relying on the check that they received to pay it towards that debt. They don't know necessarily whether it comes from a friend or relative or that particular person.
Well, were these issues ever raised in the Illinois State Court?
In Indiana, no.
In Indiana State Court proceedings?
They were not.
I just don't understand how this all could happen. Well, let's get to something that has more to do with
this case. But Mr. Sheeks is an attorney.
How do you justify sending a collection Dunning letter to somebody telling them they owe $1,050 when the check was for $350?
First of all, Your Honor, there was no Dunning letter sent by my client, Mr. Sheeks. It was
a notice
of claim, which is a pleading in court. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana has a statute that provides that a person can bring a civil action for three times the amount of that loss or of that check.
Yeah, but you don't get it automatically. You don't get it until you're not indebted to pay that or obligated to pay that until a judge says, I think this is an appropriate case to give you treble damages.
That is correct, but you're authorized to bring the claim for that amount. That's what the Indiana statute says.
But this said you owe the money, not that.
No,
you know, we may be lucky and get a judge who is sympathetic to our creditor.
Judge, the notice of claim, which is an exhibit, says that the plaintiff complains of the defendant that he's indebted to the plaintiff for $1,050 as treble damages for a bad check. It's notice pleading in Indiana.
How does a least sophisticated consumer know what all that means?
Well,
all he knows is, hey, I sent a $350 check. Maybe I shouldn't have done that, but now I owe $1,050? How does he understand how that happened?
I can't say that he knows there's this particular statute out there, but there is the notice of claim, like I say, that says it's three times the amount of the check. The Indiana statute does provide for that.
And are treble damages always awarded in Indiana in these sort of cases?
Judge, I have to say yes. There's a case, that Schnucks case I cited in my brief, in a situation where were all the elements of the check deception were met. In that case, the court did not award the treble damages. The appellate court said you need to award the treble damages. If you meet meet all the elements, yes, you do order the treble damages. I haven't seen a case where they've ordered anything less.
Your representation to this court is that they never declined to order treble damages, and
I've not seen a case where that's happened.
You've not seen a case, but do you know of any?
No.
That didn't go to litigation?
Cases settle before litigation. Oftentimes they'll settle for less than three times the amount. But there's a settlement involved there and a trade-off.
But you're saying the court always awards a treble damages?
That's my experience.
Or the reported cases?
That's my experience, yes, Your Honor.
And is that the amount required by statute, treble?
It says three times the amount of the loss. Yes.
Does it say can award, or?
It just says, the statute says you're authorized to bring a civil action in the amount of three times the amount of the loss, plus the reasonable attorney fees and court costs. It doesn't say up to, as these Eighth Circuit cases that were cited in the brief do. Judge, I think the justification, or judges, I think the justification for what the court did in the directed verdict is found in the court's entry of January of this year, and I think it fully justifies the court in finding that there was no evidence supporting any of the three issues that were raised by the plaintiff in the district court. The evidence that was presented at trial shows that Mr. Sheeks did properly state the amount of the debt. The definition in the FDCPA, as I think the court has alluded to, is any obligation or an alleged obligation, and that's what was stated in the notice of claim pursuant to the authority of the Indiana treble damage statute that we've talked about. Secondly, on the second issue, the evidence did establish that the legal status, character, and amount of the debt was not misrepresented, again, based on the authority of the Indiana treble damage statute, plus the check deception statute, that Mr. Sheeks had prima facie knowledge of the check deception by Mr. Veach, who admitted as such in court during his testimony. Judge, finally, there's absolutely no evidence that was presented allowing Mr. Veach to bring a state claim for criminal deception against Mr. Sheeks. Again, there was prima facie evidence under the Indiana check deception statute, Mr. Veach's own testimony that he did violate the statute, plus you have the treble damage statute as we've discussed. For all of the reasons stated in the brief, we believe that the court's decision affirming, or that the court's directed verdict should be affirmed in favor of Mr. Sheeks. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. How much time does he have?
30 seconds.
30 seconds?
Two very brief matters. The statute at issue, the 3424, the so-called treble damage statute, is very clearly discretionary. It used to be mandatory, and then the legislation changed and a new statute was enacted, which provides the judge the discretion to award an amount not to exceed three times the actual damages.
And when was the statutory change?
At least 7 years ago, Your Honor, because I was still in law school at the time. I don't know the exact date, but it used to be mandatory, very draconian remedies. Now it's discretionary with the judge based upon his or her evaluation of the evidence presented. I've lost cases in pursuing claims for treble damages for car dealers where they found that the circumstances mitigated in opposition to awarding enhanced damages.
So you disagree with counsel's characterization that all the cases, in all the cases under this particular statute, treble damages are awarded?
I do, based on my own personal experience with the statute and nearly 10 years of practice. I've often lost cases where I've sought treble damages. The court, the judges weigh the evidence and make a decision. I've obtained single damages, double damages, and I've also obtained treble damages, but I've had numerous losses on that issue.
Right, counsel. Thank you kindly. Thank you kindly. We will proceed to case number 3, please. The United States versus Wagner.